Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today, I am at IWG with Karen Tran Wood. This is a really big honor for me to be here. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming all the way out here to chat with me this morning.
Yeah. So IWG is a big Asian American marketing firm here in Los Angeles. We're overlooking, I think it's Beverly Hills or Hollywood back here. And Karen Tran Wood, you've been here for a long time, and you handle some of the biggest movies that come out here in Hollywood. And we're here to talk about your journey.
Yeah, excited. Let's do it.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about you coming to America.
Yeah. So me and my family, we had a very interesting story. Unlike a lot of Vietnamese refugees, immigrants who came here around 1975, shortly after the fall, we actually came here in a much later wave, in the early 1990s. So I think our experience was very different. My mom was around, and she was already in her 30s. My dad was almost in his 50s. So for us, it was truly a story of starting over and rebuilding. And my mom, she wears the pants in the family. So I think it was so ultimately her decision that, you know, we're going to do this. Hopefully we have three daughters and we want to make sure that they have a great future. And at that time in Vietnam, my dad's side, we were doing well. We came from a great family, but I think my mom, just looking ahead into the future, she feel that the opportunities, especially when you have girls in a Vietnamese family, but the opportunity is very different. So ultimately, we came here in 1990. We were sponsored by my aunt, who actually came in 75 via boat. And yeah, that was where our story really began. You know, so we were truly a working class family, because around at that time, what's great is that you have an established Vietnamese community. We mainly lived in Orange County. So you have the hub, which is Little Saigon, right? So that's the advantage, is that there, my mom wasn't struggling with like language barrier, because you were already living in that hub. However, at that time, there were a lot of people, Vietnamese people were already really well established, while we were just kind of getting our feet wet in a new country. And I was around three. I came from a family of three daughters. I'm the youngest one.
So you came to America at three?
Yes.
Okay.
So I wasn't American born, but I truly was the only person in my family that I would say was American raised.
Right.
Because both my sister, they were already in their teens when they came here. So their experience is drastically different from mine.
Wow.
Yeah.
No. We'll return to that, because I think that's a very interesting point. People who come in their teens, what they're consuming in the entertainment industry is very different from what we, quote unquote, sort of like we grew up. It's just a very different outlook, right? But when you were three, what kind of entertainment were you consuming from that point to maybe high school?
Well, first off, I don't think I remember much when I was three.
Yeah.
It was very hazy. But I think for me, maybe what I was fortunate with was I grew up mainly with my grandma. So when we came over here, obviously the parents were working day and night. Sisters were in school. So I was more or less raised by my grandma, who didn't speak English. So in order to communicate with her, I had to learn Vietnamese. And therefore, I think I'm very lucky to inherit the fact that I'm still very culturally connected, both in terms of entertainment that we consume, as well as just language. You know, I pride myself in being able to speak in Vietnamese very well. Compared to some of my friends.
Yes.
So I think, you know, my journey with entertainment truly began with sitting home with my grandma watching movies, watching Hong Kong movies and very bad Vietnamese dub. I'm not sure if you remember, but back in the days, in the 90s, we had the Blockbuster, the Hollywood Video, where we would go rent movies, right? But there's also those local Vietnamese video stores that we had around that time. And some of them were stores that specialized in renting out Hong Kong dub films.
Yeah.
And so you would go to the video store and you would come out with like stack and stack of like video cassette, right? And you would have to rewind them and then return them. Obviously, returning them is not as fun as going to rent them. But that was truly my childhood. watching Tony Leung, Maggie Cheung, those were kind of my movie icon.
Right.
I was very naive. At one point, I thought they actually spoke Vietnamese.
but only to
realize that I was watching all dub movies at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of us that learn how to speak Vietnamese, we watch, it's Phim Chu, Phim Phai Phol, right?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
Yes. Like all the different chapters of them, right? They were so fun. And I think, you know, growing up now, looking back, you see there's probably so much influence from them too. You know, Vietnamese culture, I think at least around the time I was growing up, there was so much influence from Chinese entertainment, Hong Kong entertainment, right? Whether it's film or music, there were a lot of music that were translated from a Chinese version. And that was kind of Vietnamese pop at that time.
Right.
Now we have our own pop, which we'll talk about, but that's kind of what growing up the 90s was kind of like, or even the early 2000s.
Right. Yeah, it was such a influential period in our histories. And I was probably watching those same things 20 years before you as a kid, you know, with the dubs. And that's how I learned my Vietnamese. My dad would sit there, my mom would sit there. They would tell us, like, okay, we use this in formal situations. We don't use this in normal, like, you know, dinner table at the friend's house, you know,
yang ui, nyan da. We don't talk like that.
You don't talk like that.
Yeah.
So it gave me this sort of like this ability to distinguish what languages to use. And the beauty of that period is like the extension of all these filmmakers that are Vietnamese Americans that are now living in Vietnam,
yep,
making movies, because they have this lineage of Phim Bol that they could draw from.
Right, right. So it was a fun time, surely, and I don't regret. I feel very fortunate being able to grow up during that time.
So in high school and college, did you have any inkling what you wanted to do?
No, actually. So my family were very typical in a sense, where my oldest sister is a pharmacist. My second sister is a doctor. So naturally, I was being steered more towards the health side of things. But, you know, being someone that's scared of blood, I knew that wasn't going to be my strength. So college, I went to UCLA for college, came out with political science as a major, and actually got a master in political science after that at Cal State Fullerton. So I've had quite an interesting journey professionally. I like to say I've made a lot of pivots and changes in terms of kind of figuring out what I ultimately wanted to do. So unlike a lot of people who do what I do, they would study communication at a college and just start out working as a coordinator, as a marketing publicity coordinator, assistant. I actually spent some time in government affairs and pre-law for a while, until it just hit me one day that I'm like, I think there's something missing. I don't think I'm made for, you know, such hard and dry profession like law or even health, right? I knew that I needed something where I can be a little more creative, you know, because I was doing well in those industry and profession, but I think I was lacking a lot of joy in what I do from a day to day. So by my mid-20s, that was pretty much how I was like, okay, we really need to just soul search here and see what is it that I see myself doing for the long run.
Right.
Not just for now, not just for, you know, because I have a lot of friends who are lawyers who kind of finished that path. And some of them are great lawyers. Some of them don't end up practicing anymore. So it's a tough profession. And I think, you know, unless you're truly passionate about it and passionate about using the law to help people versus just fighting for money, right?
Which is,
you know, so then, you know, that's the right profession for you. And I think I just came to the realization that that's probably wasn't the right path for me.
Yeah.
It didn't make my family happy though.
Right, I can imagine.
Yeah.
But I mean, now that I'm listening to undergrad political science, you get a master's in political science. That means that you're really well-versed in politics, right?
Yes, I mean, from a from an academia standpoint, you know, during that time, I work for the California State Senate. I'm very involved in the Vietnamese community down in Orange County. Even during my UCLA day, I was very active with the Vietnamese Student Union. Funny story is that that's where I met a lot of the people that you've interviewed on this podcast. I went to UCLA with Chris, who is now teaching, I think, in Vietnam and an influencer.
Chris Penn Travels.
Yeah.
Wow, shout out to Christian Travels. They are, you guys know each other.
As well as Sarah, who...
Sarah Coffey.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So we are all actually in the same Vietnamese student union hub. We were around the same age, more or less. We were in college around the same time. So it's very refreshing to see some of us still, you know, working and, you know, still touching media.
Yeah.
In some shape or form, or touching creative work in some shape or form. So some of us do, you know, it kind of carry on with us.
That is amazing. I'm really, really happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I think about the world of entertainment and political science, and I think about some of my close friends that are in Hollywood, a lot of them have this political science background. You know, some have worked for Obama, some have worked for, you know, these different campaigns and government. What are those things that you pull out of political science theory or the understanding of politics in America that allows you to kind of move and mobilize campaigns in the line of work that you do?
I think it's truly the idea of navigating, right? Especially during a time like this. I used to say, I mean, I met my husband from our master program studying political science, and we sometimes would talk about, gosh, how it would be such an interesting time right now to study political science. I think any of the theories that we've learned when we were there, like some of those are probably out the door, or how, you know, how do they even make sense when you're going to talk about, you know, political theory and everything that we're going through right now as a country, right? But I think, you know, believe it or not, even though people don't see an instant connection between entertainment and studying policy, I think there's a lot.
Oh, it's huge.
It's huge. Actually, the funny thing is, when I first started in PR and marketing, one of the areas that I actually wanted to specialize it for entertainment is awards campaigning. So I think that's where you kind of see the connection. Awards campaigning for a film to win an Oscar, to win, you know, anything that we see in the awards world is truly almost like a political campaign in its own way, right? So I think there's just a lot of similarity, and it's truly about navigating and adjusting and adapting to changes, dealing with crisis. You know, that's a key part of being a publicist is always, while we are probably type A people that like to always prepare and predict what's going to happen, you never know, especially with the world we're in, where social media, anything can take off. Someone can say something that can just go viral. So it's truly about crisis management and navigating and controlling the narrative to the best that you can, right? Without overstepping, you know, those on the other side who are journalists as well.
So I'd love to take a conversation from this political science, getting a master's, into where you are today. Can you walk me through that journey?
Yeah. So around my mid-20s, after, you know, realizing that I'm probably not going to be a great lawyer, probably going to be a miserable lawyer, I moved back to LA and pretty much started over. And I think maybe for me, the idea of starting over is never something I'm really scared of, because I see my mom, my family, the idea of starting over, coming here in the 90s, navigating a new country, a new lifestyle, that maybe that was kind of instilled in me.
Yeah.
So it never scared me. So basically, I moved back to LA, and one of the first places that I started, I've always known. So going back to the story with my grandma, I've always known I have a love for the cinema. I think that was where it truly started, right? And the more I look into the entertainment world, it's a vast industry. There's so many things that you can do, right? And I was it took me some time to figure out what is it that is right for me. And so I learned that, you know, when it comes to film, there's a whole career around how to market films, how to talk about films, right? I didn't see myself as a creative talent. I never have the desire to be a filmmaker. I think that's very hard. Neither do I have a desire to act or, you know, to do something that's like front and center. But I think that my strength lies in how I communicate with people and create conversation and narratives around a project, around a film, around a talent, right? And I think that's where I landed at Film Independent, which is like it's what a sound, a nonprofit organization that champion independent filmmakers, champion visual storytelling. And Film Independent, they're still around. I think they're right around the street here. Around that time, they had a lot of great programs. First off, they had a screening series at LACMA, but two of their biggest program was the Spirit Awards, as well as the LA Film Festival, which is no longer, you know, active, unfortunately.
What year was that?
Oh, I would say it's like 2013, 2014. Okay. Yeah.
That's when you started with
That's when I truly started in entertainment. Had my first red carpet experience, had my first experience working at a large scale film festival.
What did you actually do with the company?
Yeah, so when we were there, we were on the organization side. We coordinated and worked with a lot of studios to program their film screening series. The Spirit Award is a very big award show. It usually happened the night right before the Oscar. And, you know, the Oscar obviously celebrate, you know, awards contender. And the Spirit Awards sometimes do predict who's going to take the Oscar that year, depending on, obviously, with more of an independent filmmaking edge, right? So that's a big awards show in itself that I supported with press, red carpet, talent coordination. And then the LA Film Festival, same thing. There's programming, like any film festival. There's a massive programming behind it, a big PR push around it, and working with publicists who represents the film at the festival, and working with how, when you have films at festival, sometime they're films from the studio that they're premiering at your festival, or they are films that are, you know, up for acquisition, right? Films that are essentially looking for the right audience to show that it has potential for sales.
Right.
So there's a lot of different capacity in how you do PR and marketing around a festival film, around an independent
film,
which I don't do as much now, unfortunately. But I learned a lot from those days.
Well, what a great place to start, because the Spirit Awards, you know, I've had some of friends that films got in, like I think it was that year, it was maybe 2010 or 12, but it was Alan Lasparo. It was a director, Stefan Gogger. He was a Vietnamese director, actually. Yeah. And I remember going and winning, I think, an audience award from the LA Film Festival that year. But it is really the hub of, you know, independent filmmaking.
Yes.
And it's such a great place to start. Now I kind of understand your lineage and where you come from, you know, Kualasai, and then you get to, you know, the independent film arena. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, so I actually truly come from a background of being a cinema buff, working in independent film, and then, you know, now at IW for the last few years, I've had the opportunity to work on a lot of great studio projects, more commercial, big tentpole projects, which are fun and challenging in their own way. But I think I always kind of have that independent film roots still. I still appreciate those films a lot more. I used to work on a lot of documentaries. So basically, Film Independent was one of my first gig in entertainment, and it led to a lot of PR firm, PR agency jobs as a coordinator, a junior publicist, a publicist. You know, you kind of have to work your way up,
right,
essentially, in entertainment. And at those agency, I worked I repped the film, right? I would take them to Sundance, South by Southwest, Tribeca, Toronto Film Festival. And yeah, we weren't just working with studios. Like I said, we were working with essentially a sales team to drive buzz, to get these films to hopefully have a life after the festival circuit. Some of them do, some of them don't, you know, but it's a very fascinating world to be a part of. It's very different than being part of the studio side or working with the studio as a client.
Now, in your journey, I'm sure you're like seeing the Asian American film industry, you're seeing the Vietnamese film industry, both in America and in Vietnam, develop. What are some of your thoughts and reflections on the last 15 years of Vietnamese Asian films, any of it coming out of the world now that are having a surge in the world?
I think right now, especially, is such an exciting time. If you're going to talk about Vietnamese entertainment, I think there's so much going on, you know, both here with the diaspora community as well as films and music that are coming out directly from Vietnam. I still have family in Vietnam. I've been back to Vietnam 3 times now. I pretty much went back. Basically, I think of Vietnam as decades. The first time I was there was right after high school as a teenager. Second time was after college in my mid-20s. And then recently in 2023, I took my husband back. So every decade, Vietnam has changed so much. And I think right now is such an exciting time. Some of the filmmakers, obviously, we're seeing a lot of filmmakers who grew up here, like Bao Lin, Leon, right? Going back to Vietnam and just doing amazing, amazing projects. Subland, for example, one of my favorite film, and I was just at Toronto. I really wish I caught his. I didn't get to catch it. I was so busy running around with my own films. I didn't catch it. I was bummed. But it gave me very, like, In the Mood for Love by, which is one of my all-time favorite film. I think we're seeing a lot of amazing talent, you know, that's up and coming right now. I think there's so much potential. Vietnam, you know, when I was last there in 2023, it's fully this digital world now. I can't imagine how tough it is to be an artist or an actor in Vietnam because everything is so social media driven, right? I follow the music scene, a lot of things that are going on in pop music. And every time you drop a music video or something, it needs to go viral. That's like a tough call, right? And I also even noticed, like, on social, like, even before the music video dropped, there's a whole marketing campaign around it just to drum up excitement and buzz for it to even have that momentum before it dropped. And then you're seeing a lot of variety shows, right? This last few years, a lot of But the production, like, value is so crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like, the spend and the production value that they put into these variety show is so mind-blowing. So I think there's something really exciting right now going on. I grew up in Paris by Night, obviously, being from an immigrant family. And it's such a big part of, you know, our lives. Yeah. And, you know, but I think our industry is kind of in this new phase now, I would have to say. And I can't fully pinpoint what it is yet, but I think it's going to be something extremely big and exciting. I think what I hope for is that we're going to be able to bring something that's truly Vietnamese that can resonate with the global market, right? Just similar to K-pop and K-drama, right? There were a lot of investment and infrastructure building to see how big K-drama is now, to see how K-pop is. And I think we're still in the early stage of that. And I hope that, as you know, once we figure it out, it's not just merely to mimic K-pop or K-drama, right? It's going to be something very special to just us in our culture, but it's going to be embraced by the world.
You know, I pray one day that you and I can see each other and work with each other on the other side, which is in Vietnam. I know it's very tough because we all have our, you know, lives and work here in the U.S. and here in L.A. and being in the entertainment industry. But there are a few things that are happening in Vietnam this year that went crazy. Box office for Mudaw, I think it hit over 30 million.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And whether those reports are real or not, or blown up, who knows? But you go from like a Jungtan film, like the last one probably was like 28 million or 23 million, but you go into the $30 million range, right?
It's crazy.
It's crazy. And I think it's a government-backed film because it's probably one of those propaganda films. But whatever. I mean, I don't think the history of Vietnam, the government has ever really looked into backing entertainment. But now, with Mudaw, they're probably going to look into saying, wait, this is a propaganda film, but if we put more money into action films, our V-pop scene, our music scene, building infrastructure, maybe we can get like much more out of the economy.
Yes, I think it's a huge export, a culture export, and a huge driver of tourism in the
diaspora.
So yeah, I think they're up to something, and I can't wait to see what else they do.
Yeah.
I mean, even these big variety show that has been so successful, right? As someone that's from over here, and obviously seeing some of the performances, I'm very aware that there's a lot of government backing.
Right.
And you know, a lot of intention in how they stage and do certain number and focus on certain talent. Big fan of Sobin right now. So if he's watching this,
shut up.
But I think yeah, it's so fascinating, and I think we're gonna hit something great very soon.
You know, you had mentioned just a few minutes ago about you could tell that they're pouring a lot of money into structure and production. I know this might be a sensitive question, not government or anything, but more like culturally proud. Sensitive in this way is that what can we do more of, both in Vietnam and Vietnamese American, from your perspective, as somebody who pushes these types of films and projects for the mainstream, what do you think that we as a Vietnamese American community or the Vietnamese in country can do more of?
That's a good question. And that can be a whole podcast with itself. We're going to fully answer that. But, you know, I'll take some recent example that I've worked on. One of the projects that we work on here at IW recently that we were very proud of was Shogun for FX. And Shogun was a project that we came on probably about 9 months, if not a year, before it actually dropped on Hulu, on FX. And when it came to us, we knew we had something special, but there were certain things we were kind of concerned about, right? We're like, how would a story that is so feudal Japan, mostly in Japanese, how would that even resonate with like a wide audience here in the U.S., right? Will people have an appetite for this? You know, it's so dense. You know, and obviously we had a great cast in it. Hiroyuki Sanada, for example, was a very notable actor. What's funny is that at the end of the day, it still has a white man in there. So when we released some of the early trailers and assets, people are like, oh, Tom Cruise in Japan. There were a lot of conversation about the tropes.
White saviors.
It didn't help that the 80s version of Shogun reinforces all the tropes and stereotypes. So I think, you know, it was a challenge with marketing because we knew that we were going to have these conversations as just a knee-jerk reaction when people first see a little bit of it, but don't fully understand how it's going to be different, how it's truly going to invert the Western gaze this time, and it's going to be done right. And I think, you know, Shogun, I think at the end of the day, it shows that global storytelling, something that is so culturally specific, when done right with a lot of care, collaboration, it can resonate with a global audience. And I really think that that's where we as, you know, Vietnamese American creators, creative, whether here or in Vietnam, those are things that we should lead into. K-pop Demon Hunter, same thing, right? We didn't work on it, but we did host a panel with Maggie King, and it was right before K-pop Demon Hunter dropped and became the sensation that it is. And in her panel, she shared that it truly starts from the folklore of the story, right? Which is a part of her culture, Korean American heritage, a Korean Canadian, actually. I want to make sure we get that right. But the folklore was where it truly started, and the K-pop of it all came in later as kind of a way to bridge and connect and make this project reach such a global audience. And what I love about it is it's such a unique case study, because I don't think Netflix knew what they had. I think it was truly a reactive campaign after it took off. And it shows that fandom and community amplification plays such a big part in driving the success of that project. And it that outweighs any algorithm, any major marketing money, dollars, push that you can put into it, right? It comes back to a great content that everyone enjoy. And I think there's a lot about Vietnamese culture, we have the raw ingredients, I think, for that right now. We have the talent. We have the cultural richness, and we have the global mindset. So I think that there's a lot there that we can work with.
Yeah, that is 100% true. You really spelled it out really well. K-pop Demon Hunters is such a wonderful example of something that really just broke through the mainstream consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the Vietnamese culture is like right there. Right. We are right there. You know, I had Chris Doe. I don't know if you know Chris Doe. He's a marketing, branding. He's kind of like Gary Vaynerchuk. And he's here in LA. And I had him and I interviewed him about this idea of like, because years ago when I first started the podcast, I was like really amped up about like competing with K-pop.
Yeah.
And I was actually worried that Vietnamese pop or Vietnamese dramas were being drowned out by We want to emulate them so bad that we're losing. He brought up a good point. He said, every culture has to copy. So K-pop copied Backstreet Boys, NSYNC for a long time. They did it for 10 years. And then they got so good, they just started to infuse Korean attributes and culture inside of their music. In Vietnam, we're doing that right now.
Great.
We are emulating, we're copying K-pop, and I'm so relieved to hear Chris Doe talk about this, which is we are on that journey of like perfecting our craft and understanding like you got to get militant about training, about, you know, getting, I don't know if you watch Cat's Eye, the Pop Star Academy on Netflix.
I'm sure if you were talking about K-pop and Cat's Eye specifically, there are a lot of IWers that are expert at. I know enough. Cat's Eye is also very unique because Cat's Eye is based here, right? From what I'm aware of.
It's often and hot.
Mainly English, right? So they're very unique in terms of they blow the line. What is truly K-pop?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and they're always from day one, they're multinational as a group. And from day one, they're set out to be a global act. It's my basic knowledge of K-pop, yeah. Right? So we're kind of, getting into that phase now where we're like, what is K-pop? What influences what? What is true? You know, and I think with Vietnam, I totally agree with him. But I let somebody use the word inspiration,
right?
I do that every day in the work that we do as, you know, how do you take inspiration from something that you're seeing that is so successful, that's, you know, that's resonating? How do you take that as inspiration to create something of your own, right? As the next thing. So I totally agree.
What do you think in terms of Asian Americans showing up more in the entertainment world? Are you seeing more of this after, you know, after this string of K-pop and Parasite and Crazy Rich Asians? Are you seeing more, or are you seeing it plateau? Do you see it dropping because some movies bombed? What is the sort of the temperature in Hollywood right now as it relates to Asian American projects?
Yeah, so IW Group actually work on Crazy Rich Asian. It was before my time. I missed it, I think, about by a year, which I was very bummed about. But, you know, when you look at something like Crazy Rich Asian, I have a lot of thoughts and feeling about it. Love the movie. Obviously, it's not my favorite movie, and it's not something I relate to because I grew up poor. So, first off, right? But, you know, it was entertaining. It was commercial, you know, and I think it did what it needed to open the door to all these other stories that need to be told, right? Asian Americans were always lumped together. And I think that's where the struggle is that, you know, we're overlooked in so many ways because we're so diverse, but we're always lumped together. And I think that, you know, where the industry is right now, my job and what my team is doing, we truly benefited from something like a Crazy Rich Asian, you know, the work that we're able to do the last few years, all the projects that follow Crazy Rich Asian, from like a Turning Red to a Shogun. Gosh, I work on at least like 20 to 30 TV and film projects a year, believe it or not. So it's starting to get hazy what I work on and what I don't work on. But I think that speaks to volume, yeah, right, to the door that projects like that, you know, kind of allow, right? Yes, that we work on things that probably, for example, we work on American Born Chinese a few years ago. There were a lot of excitement for that. It was adapted from a famous graphic novel. So there was already a fan base there. Did a huge marketing push for it. But, you know, it didn't.
You picked up.
It didn't perform. It didn't get renewed, you know. So, yes, you're going to have that. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's learnings from everything, you know. But I think the fact that people are starting to realize that there's an appetite for culture-specific stories is truly the start of it. And I don't think that that's going to slow down. I think that it's good business.
Yeah.
If you're seeing things that are successful, like a K-pop Demon Hunters, Shogun, Crazy Rich Asian, it shows that our story, they're good money. They make good money. They're a success. And we should make more of them. Yeah.
When I think about what you just said about money being divided by different cultures in the Asian American scene, how I often think about corporations and the bottom line and budgets when I think about, well, how can mainstream American corporations, film companies, and parents of film companies justify spending in the Vietnamese market or just the Korean market or just the Filipino market when we make up such a small, tiny percentage? I've always wondered what the math looks like.
So, I'm trying to see what I can say that will get me in trouble.
You don't have to answer that if it's too sensitive.
No. I'll put it this way. Let's just say, you know, when you work in multicultural marketing, there's always a struggle. It's an uphill battle. You know, despite all the representation, all the success that people are seeing, it's still an uphill battle when it comes to fighting for budget and investment. Let's just say that I work with, you know, executives who are, yes, very bottom line driven and see it in plain math. So, for example, you know, they're like, Karen, IW, you guys handle the Asian American audience. That's about 7% of the U.S. population. So this is how much. That's how much.
That brush makes sense, down. Right? There's a ratio.
But it's also such a narrow approach to marketing if you think about it. Because first off, if you look at box office numbers, you know, if you look at the audiences that are showing up opening week to any big movies, like we work on Lilo and Stitch, for example, right? Multicultural audiences actually makes up more than 50% of the people. You know, Hispanic, Black community, Asian, we make up more than 50% when it comes to box office turnout for most of these films. So there's something there, right? And then, you know, I always try to educate and my clients and say, we need to look at this more broadly, right? Multicultural consumers are such drivers of culture. And even Asian Americans, right? Things like we talk about K-pop, K-drama, Japanese culture is huge as well. Anything inspired by anime, manga, right? So we're such big culture drivers. And, you know, those things like actually resonate to such a wide audience, to such a mainstream audience, if you think about it. So it's just, I feel like a missed opportunity to always look at it so narrowly that you guys are 7% of the population right now, without understanding like the potential growth. Asian Americans is a big growing population right now, and we have our buying power, as you mentioned, our disposal income is huge. We're so big on luxury spending.
Yeah.
So there's money there, right? And there's just so much influence there. So I think it's just truly an education process to kind of change that narrative on how you look at spending and budget.
Okay. I'm going to ask another sensitive question. Yes, buying power, spending power we have.
But do we spend? Does the Asian American population, do we spend on things that we view sometimes as frivolous, you know, entertainment? And I ask that because I want to inspire the next generation of filmmakers and content makers that, wait a minute, 7% is what we make up, but 50% is multicultural spending. But we do have big pocketbooks, but we are not given the opportunities sometimes because of the pigeonholing of the budgets and the bottom lines by executives who are not in the space that we're in.
So I think we do spend when it's something that we're passionate and loyal to. I think that comes to just plain and simple. We are very picky. Asian Americans are hard to market to. We are extremely picky. We're digital savvy. We like to stay at home. We like to stream more so than going to the movie theater, I think, if you're looking at consumer behaviors. But we do spend. And I think just to look at it, marketing these days, the key core audience that we're looking at are really Gen Z and the younger, right? That's truly where the opportunities are. And I think, you know, as someone that's an old millennial, I can already say that my spending behavior is very different from my mom. My mom is extremely frugal, right? I want to spend, that's not necessary. Me, I'm already like, why not? You just, you know, if you like it, just buy it.
Right.
So you're already seeing changes in behavior when it comes to buying. And then, you know, you're talking about Gen Zs who are people who grew up digitally, you know. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of changes in terms of consumer behavior just within our population that we need to pay attention to a bit more and reach them where they are.
You know, I'm going to switch tracks here and go into AI and the future of AI. It doesn't sound like it's going to affect your business marketing so much because whatever product.
I hope so.
Yeah. I hope not.
Right? I hope not. I mean.
Do you see it affecting your business much? I mean, you're still in the market something.
You know, I think it's such an unprecedented time. I'm not going to like, you know, close my eye and go, no, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, because it's something that's evolving so quickly. So you don't know how advanced it's going to get. You know, and I think with AI, my philosophy is that AI should enhance and amplify you rather than cripple and replace you. If you're finding yourself in a position where your job or whatever you do is easily replaced by AI, you know, I think there's a lot more to unpack there, right? So I think that at the end of the day, everything needs to be very, creativity especially needs to be very human-centered. Like I said, my journey started from my love of the cinema and how the cinema connects culture. You know, there's a lot of human connections when it comes to art. And I really don't think that AI can replace that in a true sense. AI will expedite things, make things faster, easier, potentially cheaper. And I think that we're seeing that in production right now when it comes to the entertainment world. But you know, I still have a lot of faith for mankind. is kind of my takeaway when it comes to AI.
When I think about the decisions that you have to make sometimes, I think about figuring out what makes something good. AI has to figure that out. We have to figure that out as humans. But I want to ask you specifically, what do you think makes a good film? What do you think makes a good product? What do you think makes BTS good? What are the things in your soul that you feel makes things really high quality?
All right. Well, this is totally my subject.
Your take.
This is what Karen feels, right? I know, like,
while we're here.
Okay. I think, first off, when it comes to the movies or K-pop, anything, music, people lean to them to escape, right?
Okay.
And I think that's why, you know, people like to go watch action film. They're not my kind of thing, but people like to spend 3 hours going to the movie to watch, you know, buildings fall apart, Avengers fighting the bad guys. It's a way to escape, right? And that's totally, I think that's truly one of the biggest value of entertainment. Like I mentioned, for me, I lean to film to understand culture, to bridge cultural gap. Stories, to tell stories, right, that we all can connect to on a human level. I truly, you know, coming from an independent film background, that's how I look at the cinema. That's how I look at entertainment, right? It comes back to a great story. And, a lot of things in our world, especially with marketing and publicity, it feels very bleeding. 1 minute, you know, it's viral and everyone's talking about it. The next minute, someone's talking about something else or talking about, you know, what's going on in the world or what our president is tweeting or saying, right? So, like, I feel like what we do on a day-to-day basis is about timing, and sometimes it can feel so fleeting. But to me, a good movie lasts forever, right? A good movie stay with you forever. I think I mentioned this earlier, but one of my all-time favorite movie is In the Mood for Love. And believe it or not, when I first watched that movie the first time, I was so young, I didn't get it. I didn't get it, but it's a movie where if you come back and watch it at other phases in your life, you appreciate so much about it, right? Like the idea of, at the end of the day, it was just really Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung. If that's all that you're going to see, that's all you're going to get.
That chemistry.
But like the emotion, the themes of restraint and constraint, right? That's the beauty of it. That's the human connection that I'm talking about. And you know, I believe that there's an audience for every movie. So I'm sure there are people out there who are like, that movie, I didn't get it. I didn't care for it. And I'll be like, sure, I'll disagree, but you know, I think there's an audience for every film, and I would say that with music, and you know, it connects us on a different, and everyone responds to it differently, and I think that's the beauty of art.
Now, what happens when the product was not good, and it's brought to you, so you have to work it?
I can't let you get out.
Got to know, right? I mean, I'm not here to ask the easy question, you know? I don't want you to burn your customer, your clients, but I do wonder about these things. But when I'm like, when you guys reached out to me, I'm like, oh my God, when it comes to IWG, I've known about Bill LaMotta my entire basin existence, right? And to be asked to come here, I'm like, I can't not ask these questions, right?
You should probably go over a few doors down and ask Bill what he does with a bad movie that he had to work on or coach or consult for. I would like to see how he answered that.
But we don't have to bring up any projects. We could just, you know, I mean, there's got to be some general ways to address something that you're not connected to.
Yeah, so I think the downside of doing what we do, marketing PR, is that the project is done when it comes to us. We, you know, like it's done, it's more or less locked. I guess once in a while, we do come in early enough where it's still being made and we get to read scripts and we get to advise. But whether we advise and whether they take it, you know, and edit to heart and make changes is totally up to the filmmakers, the studio, the network, right? But most of the time, like for me and my team, our lead time on working on a film campaign is pretty short, if you think about it. It's somewhere between 3 to 2 months. Something like a Shogun is unique, where we come on so much earlier, right? But your average campaign time frame is 2 or 3 months. So you're kind of doubt the card, you know? And I think, you know, we definitely have been doubt cards where we come in more from, you know, a crisis calm perspective, more so than anything.
And you let the client know, like, hey, we're in a crisis here. We don't see
it. We're just, you know, flagging things, right? So I think for us, where we add the most value, because I used to do general market PR and marketing before, right? In my independent film days that I did general market. I didn't, you know, it's only at IW that I started in the multicultural marketing world. And I think the key differentiator is with multicultural studio executive clients, they look to you to advise them on what is culturally, what will culturally resonate, what is problematic, right? And there's definitely projects that we work on that are not very let's just say the multicultural audience would not respond well to it. You know, from movies that people have say are whitewashing. We've seen it all. We've dealt with it all. And I think the true value that we bring is really giving our clients honest advice, opinion on what we think or how we think people would react to this film, when they cut it out, or even a trailer, anything. And it from there, helping them strategize, right, on how to navigate those reactions. I really think that's, you know, it's a fun part of the job, yeah, in a different way.
Right.
Yes, when you're working on something like Shogun, K-pop Demon Hunter, they're a great project. You're excited, you're proud. But sometimes you are dealt cards that are way more challenging. And I think that there are learnings. And I think those are the projects that truly build great PR and marketing professionals, right? It's not always working on things that just catches on fire.
Right.
Yeah.
Karen, thank you so much for having me here today. Is there anything else that you wanted to include in dialogue? And after, I really, truly would like to have, you know, this podcast every year, every 2 years, we get back and we kind of refresh with you about the status of the industry. You know?
Yeah, no, first off, thank you so much. I mentioned to you, been a fan of the podcast for quite some time, have had a lot of guests that on this podcast that I know or really look up to, admire, like Go Kyu Jin. You've had some really great folks on this. So if anything, I feel like you know, there are some big shoes for me to fill with this. But I really hope that you know, we'll have more opportunities to talk about how the industry changes every year. And I think with IW Group, you know, we're truly people that, if you know Bill very well, he's not someone that likes to beat his chest.
What?
You know, we do the work for the client. And when you're a PR marketing professional, you're truly behind the curtain. You know, I think that I was trained by some very old school publicists or bosses back then who are like, if you're in the spotlight, if you're on that step of repeat or carpet, you're not doing your job now.
You're
a it shouldn't be about you. It should be about your project. It should be about the talent. You're in black. You know, you need to treat your profession in a very serious and professional way. And, you know, I agree with that. I understand that now. So, you know, rarely does we as an agency really get to talk a lot about our work. I'm sure some projects I mentioned, you probably don't even know that we work on it, because that's how good we are at our job, right?
But I do think, though, that it's nice in this modern age to peek behind the curtain to see what you guys do. And for me, I say every year to have you back on, but I don't, like, we should do it every 3 months to talk about the work that you guys do, because I think it's compelling, but it's also a way to let our community know, wait a minute, there's a lot of action happening. And without people talking about it, like from the inside, how do people know, right? And especially having a Vietnamese woman handle this, you know, pushing of mainstream films, of films that are made by Asian Americans. I mean, all of it is so important for our community.
And I guess we'll leave with this note. I haven't had a chance to work on a Vietnamese project yet, believe it or not, despite all the films and TV shows that I've worked during my time here. I'm still waiting for that project. So I hope that whenever that project happens, I'll be able to have a chat with you about it.
Yeah, it might happen next year.
Maybe.
I'm just putting it out there. It might happen next year. There's some big projects out there.
Doesn't manifest it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Work on a lot of Japanese projects, you know, Chinese-centric project. I haven't had a true Vietnamese project yet that I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's show them how this is gonna work. So I'm very optimistic, and I'm just gonna manifest it.
Hopefully,
the next time I'm back, we'll be able to talk about that.
Yeah, they're being shot right now. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Sharon. Thank you so
much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.